The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest. It's Hammer Time edition. It's Wednesday, April 25th, 2018. On today's show, in keeping with Dana's taste for glib ultraviolence, we discuss Killing Eve, a new... I got you, Julia. I got you. We discuss Killing Eve, a new BBC serial. It stars Sandra Oh as an investigator on the trail of a female contract killer. And then You Were Never Really Here is a grueling and intense existential noir. It stars Joaquin Phoenix as a hired gun whose specialty is rescuing victims of human trafficking. And finally, should I, should you, should we, hashtag delete Facebook. Joining me today is Slate's editor-in-chief, Julia Turner. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steven.
All right, digging right in. Killing Eve is a new BBC import. You can catch it streaming on BBC America's site or purchase it a la carte at iTunes, apparently. It stars Sandra Oh as Eve Pilastri, a bored spy bureaucrat who finds herself chasing a playfully heartless, really chillingly heartless, sociopath, a beautiful contract killer named Villanelle, played to icy perfection by Jodie Comer. It's a cat and mouse between a gumshoe and a sociopath in which both parts are played by women, which I think is new, unique, and quite, in this instance, quite captivating. It's set against tasty European backdrops, and it's showrun by none other than Phoebe Waller-Bridge, she of Fleabag fame. What is not to love? Why don't we listen to a clip?
Didn't?
How would you kill me if you could?
I don't know. Push you down the stairs?
No, seriously, they come for you immediately.
I don't know. Flatter you to death. Okay. How would you kill me?
I'd paralyze you with saxitoxin and suffocate you in your sleep. Chop you into the smallest bits I could manage, boil you down, put you in a blender, then take you to work in a flask and flush you down a restaurant toilet.
You've really thought about that.
Smart, huh?
Very.
Sexy?
Hugely.
Do you want supper?
Ooh, yes. Thank you.
Okay. Love you.
Love you.
Julia, why don't I start with you? It's sardonic, it's glib, it's sharp, it's funny. It's a little over the top, a little OTT. It's pretty cool. What'd you think?
Watch this show. This show is so worth watching. It's so good. I mean, I feel like we discuss this on our show sometimes. We start a lot of shows, and many of them I admire and think are great. Like, I really enjoyed Mindhunter, that Netflix show with Jonathan Groff. Really interesting. I was very captivated by the story for the first few episodes. Was like, this is one of the ones I'm going to keep watching. Did not. Never went back to it. Don't know what happened. Did they catch that guy? Not sure. But this one, I'm... utterly going to devour because it mixes some of the fun of a sharp, witty, unusual procedural with these completely compelling and unusual performances by women in these roles. And it's not as though we've never seen women as kick-ass super agent spies of great composure and politesse, a la Sidney Bristow in Alias. And I don't know, have we seen female contract killers? I mean, I guess there was just Red Sparrow with Jennifer Lawrence. I didn't see that movie. It seemed like she was some kind of contract killer, femme fatale, right? It's not like the femme fatale is a figure that doesn't exist, right?
So what is unusual about this show? I agree it feels completely unusual and fresh, and I'm going to keep watching it.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is that the two characters, the assassin and the spy, are configured a little bit differently than they usually are. The assassin is, her beauty is a part of what allows her to get close to targets and murder them, but it's not presented as like the point. You know, she's not a Bond girl who's just vamping into things in gowns all the time and then, oops, accidentally, the doofus man, you know, didn't even realize that she was a threat and whoops, he's dead. Like, she deploys many different tactics. Each of her kills has a different signature. She kills men and women. There's some mystery and invention in how she uses her talents to make people dead, and it's not all vamping. Meanwhile, Sandra Oh's Eve is competent and messy. I feel like we've seen hyper-competent spies. I feel like we've seen sort of competent by accident spies. One of the reviews we read compared her to Melissa McCarthy's character in the recent movie Spy, which actually isn't completely out of line.
Right. She's a little bit comically fumbling. She's not one of those hard-edged, hyper-competent people, nor is she dysfunctional in the way that has, I think, become its own sort of cliche. The female hero who's secretly alcoholic or a horrible mother or a horrible partner, right? I mean, she's not this sort of dysfunctional, cranky, mean person.
Right. And the plot really is very similar to McCarthy's Spy. It's like she's a back office bureaucrat who gets put into the field. And what does she do when suddenly her hunches are not just the things she's whining about nobody listening to, but the things that she has to marshal a whole team to follow and consider and think about their safety and everyone else's. So both of those things add texture to each of their scenes where you're seeing a version of the spy and a version of the assassin who are slightly different than what we've typically seen. There's also some mystery about exactly what Villanelle is. Villanelle is the assassin, and she's so heartlessly psychopathic, and she goes for some kind of evaluation or assessment at some point that makes you wonder if she's entirely human or if she's been cultivated in some way. Like the question of where this assassin fits into a larger system is a bit of a tease. Again, not, you know, not unusual. There's Orphan Black and all the well, I don't even remember what all those clones were exactly. But, you know, that's, again, not a new element. But so there's all these ways in which the texture of the different elements are surprising. But then there's just tone. And for that, I think we have Phoebe Waller-Bridge to thank, where there's this just intense mix of suspense and unnerving comedy that is snackable.
Mm. Dana, I take it from your line of questioning, maybe your enthusiasm is slightly less unqualified.
No, not at all. I'm completely impassioned by this series, and I don't really have a complete excuse as to why. That's kind of why I asked Julia, what do you think it is about this show that sets it apart and makes it unusual? I think it ultimately really is the writing, although both those performances are exceptional, especially Jodie Comer's, I think. It's really girly in the best way, and by that I don't mean that it's sort of flouncy and flouncily feminine or something, but it is very concerned with female psychology, with female sexuality, with fashion, with pleasure. It's extremely pleasurable to watch. It's the sort of show where it's actually perfect to dole it out in week by week installments because it's extremely suspenseful and fun and pleasurable, and you just can't wait to get that particular shot of that flavor again.
I'll dive in and say that I love it. It combines a bunch of different things, right? So it's a woman chasing a woman, which I do think is unusual. I can't think of an instance of it off the top of my head, though there may well be one. The polar nihilism of the villain, possibly villain. I mean, she certainly seems as if she's the ultra villain of the piece, though I agree with Julia, we're being set up for at least some kind of a reveal or twist about who she is. But the total iciness and nihilism of her combined with this feline playfulness is riveting. It's as riveting as anything I've seen in loosely described this genre since like Buffalo Bill and Silence of the Lambs or Hannibal Lecter. I mean, she's just magnetically fucked up and empty in one way, but also highly detailed portrait of her as a individual being in the world. Like you sort of believe that she actually exists and there are things that she cares about, though they're possibly have more to do with style than, I mean, she has, you know, the very opening scene of the whole thing is her looking to a third party as adult as he smiles at a young kid and then back to the young kid to see how the kid smiles back. And we're just being told in this economic and I think quite brilliant way that this person just doesn't understand what that interaction is, right? That very first interaction that makes us human and makes us kind of enter into the social contract or emotional or empathetic contract with other beings, she's staring at it and then kind of imitates it in this empty way. And it's totally horrifying and sets up what's to come. I think the other really unique thing about the show, which you guys pointed to as well, is that this is based on a series of genre novels written by a man. It's showrun by Phoebe Waller-Bridge, whose genius, apparently, is, you know, super individuating the inner lives of women. in ways that tend towards the glib, the sardonic, and the heartless, but also trying to understand what it is about women that have made them defensive in the face of the world. And what I like about Sandra Oh is that in addition to being both bumbling and super competent, and is that she's not a simple foil for Villanelle. There's a way in which they're alike, which is that Eve has a kind of glib attitude, as cops do towards dead bodies, right? They're kind of grist for interesting problem solving. And I think that that's a coping mechanism that law enforcement probably does resort to. And so there's this interesting thing she's doing, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is doing, which is, you know, both of these people kind of have interestingly compromised inner lives. And then it's just the sort of, it's tight and has a pace to it that just moves you forward into it as a genre piece. I want to raise an issue with it. I'm curious whether this occurred to either one of you. Something about Phoebe Waller-Bridge's immense virtuoso gifts when it comes to writing a kind of glib dialogue paired with ultra violence, because it is very, very violent, made me feel as though there was a little bit of nihilism and heartlessness to the show itself. It's not just about those things. It is those things a little bit, and that made me squirm, but that may be part of its genius. Resolve it for me.
I think that's part of what's fascinating about it, though, in that we have Villanelle, and I can't wait to meet her, like, sister psychopaths, Sistina, Sonnet, and whatever else. But Phoebe Waller-Bridge seems very interested in women behaving badly and acknowledging that actually women do behave badly, and that if you really want to represent women on screen and have them more fully portrayed, you've got to look at what makes them be bad. And I think Sandra Oh's character, though good and extremely root-forable and extremely touching, I mean, I love your point about fashion, the part where she buys a va-va-va-voom dress to go to dinner with somebody who might have some intel for her, and she, like, wants to wear a bra with it, but it's, like, not a dress you can wear a bra with, and she has an argument with her fellow spy about whether she has to wear a bra. Like, of course, every time you wear a fancy dress, one of the problems is what bra can you wear with the fancy dress? I've never seen that represented on any screen. And the notion that this, like, competent yet bumbling person would be like, oh, fuck, I don't have a bra that goes with this dress. It's like, great. That's great.
Mm-hmm. And,
like,
it's a plot point. Or what about the pink tulle baby doll dress that Villanelle wears for her psychological evaluation? It's such a great choice.
No, the clothes in it are so great. So there's all of this texture of what female minds sometimes think about that's fascinating. But I think what's getting set up here is Sandra Oh, as you say, Steve, has these kind of callous impulses, right? The bodies are a problem. The murders are a problem. They're intellectually fascinating. They're interesting. The work is compelling. It's more compelling than her husband. Like, she's a person who I think is headed towards perhaps doing some things that are heartless. And how does a woman with a heart become heartless compared to this just, you know, by nature, by design, utterly heartless foil in Villanelle, I think is what this story is about. And so I didn't see that cruelty as a blithe moral problem of the show, but actually its subject. And I think that's why, even though it's snackable and violent, you can not feel bad watching it, because I think it's actually interested in
snackable and violent, but totally okay.
Morally fine.
I mean, Steve, just thinking about Fleabag, which was Phoebe Waller-Bridge's sort of one-woman show that turned into a series, I can't imagine that she won't go down exploring exactly this road, because that's what Fleabag was really all about, right? It started off with this woman who was sort of glamorously behaving badly, and she had this direct-to-camera address, which is something I didn't really like about that show, but was a way that she established this complicity with the viewer of, aren't I cute as I behave badly? And then as the show went on, of course, she was exposed as a person who actually was bad and actually was suffering the consequences of that behavior. And I can't imagine, given how important that dynamic was to Fleabag, that it won't occur in this show as well. For what it's worth, I think this is better than Fleabag. I didn't watch that to the end, and there's no way that I'm not going to keep going with this one.
Okay, I don't want you to think I wasn't paying attention to every word you were saying, but have you ever noticed that trope report is a palindrome? I just noticed it.
Welcome to Steve's brain.
All right, it's called Killing Eve, three thumbs sky high. We loved it. Phoebe Waller-Bridge meets a psychological thriller. Check it out. BBC America, iTunes. We'd love to know what you think about it at facebook.com/culturefest. And now we move on. All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we talk about our business. We surely have some. Julia, what do you got?
Well, we have an announcement that's really an announcement for you, Steve, which is that we are doing a live show on June 2nd. And I'll tell you what's happening on June 2nd. Dana and I are getting kidnapped by Steve. He's dragging us and some of you to whatever secret, exciting thing he's been trying to tell us about and get us interested in for 6 months.
All we had to do was act like we didn't care and it turned into a live show.
I know. This is like really depressing because it suggests that the rules is real. Like if you feign disinterest, you will only fan theirs. But anyway, we feigned disinterest. But then Steve got Faith, Slate Superwoman of Live Events, Faith Smith, in cahoots with him to plan an event at this secret location. So we're doing a secret summer getaway on June 2nd, somewhere in Rensselaer County, New York at 3 p.m. So again, 3 p.m., Saturday, June 2nd, quote unquote, somewhere in Rensselaer County. Haven't you always had on your bucket list, oh yeah, I want to go, I want to see the pyramids. I want to maybe do one of those crazy Antarctica adventures. And then I really got to get to somewhere in Rensselaer County. That's number three. Steve, make your pitch. Why should people be excited to come join us at this mystery locale?
Okay, well, I know that county delineations are completely determinative in one sense of like place and destiny, but just as an FYI, Rensselaer County is the county directly north of Columbia County, the county that I live in. Columbia County is best known for rolling farmlands filled with sheep. Rensselaer County is probably best known for hosting the capital city of Albany. But don't let that fool you.
He's taking us to Albany.
I'm not taking you on a tour of the State House and telling you how a bill becomes a law. I am taking you someplace remote, bucolic, and quite beautiful. And for those of you who you know gave into my shenanigans once before and went on the secret hike, you know, this hike which ended in a cornucopia of wild blueberries, this is that times some, you know, super high exponential power of beauty and captivating charm. So
more fun exactly and beautiful, more fun and beautiful than the blueberry hike. That's a high bar.
Yes,
despite teasing you, the blueberry hike was pretty fucking great.
That was pretty special.
We have to kind of keep this on the DL, keep it a little secret. I have toyed with the idea of blindfolds and a white van, but I think that's maybe a little bit, the lawyers tell me that gets into some issues. So we're not going to rendition you up to Rensselaer County. What we're going to do instead is, I think, shoot you an email if you purchased a ticket telling you precisely how to get where you're supposed to go. But we'll work out those mechanics, but you'll be let in on the secret. You do have to sign a comically unenforceable non-disclosure agreement to never tell anybody where you went. But I think it's going to be really fun if there's going to be food, libation, music, and a gab fest. I can say that much.
The way I would pitch it is, if you're anywhere in the general Hudson Valley vicinity and or the Berkshires and you want to drive a little bit and listen to a live show with us and explore somewhere beautiful and Steve anointed, you should go to slate.com/live to buy tickets. Saturday, June 2nd, 3 p.m. It'll be a great kickoff to the summer at a super secret location. I also wanted to shout out a great conversation on a Slate podcast this week, or a recent Slate podcast. I listened over the weekend to the most recent Double X Gab Fest. They also discussed Neri Oxman on their Plus segment, who we discussed on our Plus segment last week, Brad Pitt's girlfriend. So if you have not yet joined Slate Plus, you should join Slate Plus and listen to both segments. They posited an amazing theory about Neri Oxman almost by accident, where they read her many tweets out loud and were like, it seems like they're written by a bot. And they took the conversation in a different direction, but I bet they are. She's at the MIT Media Studies lab. Like, suddenly I was like, that's what makes sense of the way she talks. I wonder if she's got some like humanistic futuroid generator and that's why her tweets are so whack. It was my new theory of Neri Oxman. But anyway, fantastic show. The Double X crew is always worth listening to. Give that episode a listen. And Slate Plus today, we're going to answer a great listener question. What piece of culture when someone tells you it's their favorite makes you love that person instantly. To hear segments like that and get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus, our membership program, which is a great way to support our podcast and all of the journalism that we do. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gabfest and your other favorite Slate shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate shows and a ton of other great benefits. So if you'd like to support the Culture Gabfest, episode 501, go to slate.com/cultureplus and join Slate Plus today. All right, onward.
You Were Never Really Here is a brutal noir sort of thriller starring Joaquin Phoenix as Joe, an Iraqi war vet suffering from PTSD, we come to understand. He's also a special kind of fixer. He's hired to rescue women from human trafficking rings by any means necessary, often the more brutal the better, though his specialty is introducing a ball-peen hammer to the inside of your brain cavity. The movie is written and directed by the estimable Lynn Ramsey, she of Ratcatcher, and We Need to Talk About Kevin, among other movies. This movie was received rapturously with a 7-minute standing ovation at Cannes. It has divided critics. You will not find out what I think about it due to an obscure conflict of interest. I'm going to recuse myself from the following conversation. In my stead is Sam Adams, Slate contributor and film critic. All right. Thanks, guys.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Sam.
Thanks for stepping in. We needed more people who were really there at screenings of You Were Never Really Here. So we're grateful for your expertise.
Great.
All right. Before we get into our discussion, let's listen to a clip from the movie. As you'll hear in this clip, it's a movie with very little dialogue and lots of silence that Julia will regard as portentous and pretentious. So in this scene, you hear the senator who is sending Joaquin Phoenix's character, Joe, out after his runaway daughter.
You have kids, Joe? Nina. Her name is Nina. I've heard of these places. Underage girls.
Senator, if she's there, I'll get her.
Cleary said you were brutal.
I can be.
Dana, you liked this movie. Defend yourself.
Well, I'm more curious about why you hated it. And I don't actually know anything about what Sam thought of it. So that's exciting. Okay, well, let me set it up a little bit by saying that this was one of my most anticipated movies of the year, probably so far. And in that context, it was maybe a little bit disappointing. So this movie premiered at Cannes last year. As Steve said, it got a standing ovation. There was also a whole drama surrounding its appearance at Cannes. And Sam, maybe you know the story of this better than I do, but I think Lynn Ramsey was still wrapping up the editing and it wasn't clear whether she would get it to the festival. It was the very last movie that screened and it was really rapturously received. And then it took an incredibly long time to come out. I thought it would come out last year in 2017. So for it finally to drop in the spring of 2018, the new Lynn Ramsey, she's very prolific. She's only made, this is her fourth movie, was just an event that I was extremely excited for. So in that context, it may be considered disappointing as I don't think it's her best movie. Her best movie, I think, remains Morven Callor, the one movie Steve didn't mention in his roundup, which is maybe to me one of the best movies of the early 2000s. But this does bear such a stylistic stamp. It's so it has such a unique voice that I recommend it to people who are interested in Lynn Ramsey, Joaquin Phoenix, two very interesting artists, I think, to follow, or noir movies that do very unusual things with the genre of noir. Within that framework, I do have some reservations and just some flat-out confusion about what this movie is trying to do and whether it accomplishes it. And I reviewed the movie, if you want to go read on Slate in more detail about that response. But in general, I would say that I was terrified and paralyzed by it, which is, you know, something that not every crime thriller manages to accomplish. Sam, what about you?
I've seen all of Lynn Ramsey's movies except Morven Callor, which I gather is sort of like being, oh, I've seen a bunch of Scorsese's, but not Taxi Driver. But, you know, she's just one of those people I've come to accept as just kind of not my thing. So I can kind of, like, I think this movie's beautiful and, like, mesmerizing in places, and I like what Joaquin Phoenix is doing in it, and it just left me completely cold, despite all of that.
This movie left me more than cold. This movie left me incredulous that anybody ever thought it was good. I can understand that there is art and style to the storytelling choices, the compositions. Like, it's not artlessly made, but in some ways it seems like even more of a failure than it would have been if it were just a badly made movie, because all of the artistry is in service of this pompous, deeply self-serious, ponderous, familiar story that centers on kind of the unspecified ambient agony of a guy who's been through a lot and his heroic, salvific journeys saving fresh-skinned young women from sexual exploitation. I mean, this movie is like already taken, as a friend of mine put it. Like, it's the plot is ludicrous. Like, there's some kind of eyes wide shut all the way to the top sex ring, and we spend a lot of time in the dewy company of this poor, inert, traumatized young woman who we don't really get to know anything about other than her sort of alluringly traumatized self. Like, it seems to fetishize her trauma. It seems to fetishize his trauma. And then, I mean, there are some moments of humanity and spirit in Joaquin Phoenix's performance, particularly in his relationship with his mother. I enjoyed those scenes. I thought that felt fresh. This movie seems deeply high on its own supply. Like, there's a kind of funeral scene, I won't say for who, deeper into the movie, that is so much about style that and so devoid of substance that I was just, like, laughing at the movie. And I could not – I can't – I'm having, like, an Emperor Has No Clothes response to this movie. Like, this movie strikes me as laughably bad. And I – what am I missing? Like, what is the – I could not get with this movie. I could not even get far enough into it to be like, for all of its technique, none of that technique, I was unable to fall under its spell, because I kept just thinking, this is familiar, that's obvious, that's, you know, it's dumb. Like, I couldn't lose myself in it.
The story is overfamiliar, and I say that in my review as well. It's a genre piece, right? It's a kind of neo-noir. People have compared it to Taxi Driver. I don't think it has much in common with Taxi Driver at all. The relationship between the sex trafficking victim and Joaquin Phoenix is completely different from the kind of obsessive, sick relationship that Travis Bickle has with the Jodie Foster character. It's based on a novella by Jonathan Ames, who is known for Bored to Death, creating the HBO comedy Bored to Death, and is basically a noir writer. It's a super, super dark, nihilistic little novella. But I completely disagree, Julie, that there's no humor in it. I think that the Joaquin Phoenix's performance is astounding precisely because he manages to bundle all of the trauma that you mentioned with what I found some very funny character moments. He's suicidal, right? This character that he plays is an Iraq war vet, or a vet of some Middle Eastern war, and also seems to be a survivor of childhood abuse. And those things come back to him in these really harsh flashbacks. But almost all of his suicide attempts are played also for this sort of strange black comedy where you're not sort of sure whether he actually wants to kill himself or whether that's just sort of his way of amusing himself in the misery of his life. It's a movie about alienation and depression, for sure. But I don't find it this nihilist exercise of gloom and doom and heavy True Detective self-seriousness. If I did, I wouldn't like it. Sam, did you sense any humor in his performance? I mean, I just think Joaquin Phoenix alone is a reason to see this movie. He's incredible.
I mean, I think as close as I come to a reason to see the movie, that would be it. I mean, I think that Ramsey is, as she kind of did in We Need to Talk About Kevin, which is about kind of a, you know, school massacre and how, that character kind of comes to be. I mean, she's sort of starting with a really played out genre and then trying to subvert it or poeticize it or something. And I think she does that to an extent, but it's also like kind of starting in a hole. And part of my block with the movie is just, why would you start in that hole to begin with? Like, why make another movie about this? Part of the backstory for this movie to me is that this should have been her fifth movie instead of her fourth. And she started shooting a Western with Natalie Portman called Jane Got Her Gun. And that kind of turned into a disaster. And she eventually left, and the movie was completed by a different director and then completely ignored. And this movie has there's a kind of feeling of cathartic release to me. That partly is sort of that, like, she got mired in this bigger studio production. And then it was like, fuck it, I'm just going to go make this crazy thing with Joaquin Phoenix and bang it out really quickly and just so there's this kind of feeling of eruption and release to me that it weirdly reminds me of like the Terry Gilliam movie Tideland, which he made after kind of having his studio debacle with Brothers Grimm. And so there's that kind of feeling of kind of unleashed id to it, which I appreciate, but also feel like maybe leash that a little.
Yeah, I mean, she's not a disciplined filmmaker, that's for sure. And I think a lot of why she got fired from Jane Got Her Gun, I'm not clear on all the details of it. She was sued afterwards by the producers of the movie, but I think it had to do with her, you know, intuitive and not particularly studio-friendly style of filmmaking. But that style meshes so well with Joaquin Phoenix's way of acting. I think what really energized me about this movie was the sense that they were really collaborating, that there was a true collaboration happening between the performer and the director, and that only the two of them could achieve that kind of tone. I mean, we haven't talked that much about what the style is. We keep saying, oh, it's all style, no substance. But what the style is, we haven't really described. How would you all describe it?
The thing that I think is most admirable about the style, and I found parts of it really compelling and parts of it really overdone, was the film's approach to violence. It's a film about a guy who kills people with a ball peen hammer to the head. It's not actually a movie where you see a ton of the violence. You see the after effects of it. You see the moment after. There's a really brilliant scene that I hope will be studied in film classes for years to come where he stages the Taken style rescue, but you only see it through security camera footage, and you get these kind of glimpses and hints of the scene that would be the like action tour de force of the shittier version of this movie. Obviously, there's artistry to that. Obviously, there's something compelling about that. There are other scenes to me that just felt cliched where, you know, the car is running over the bridge and you see the city and the music. It's a Johnny Greenwood score, we should note. So it has artistry there as well, obviously.
And very grating, hard to listen to score. The opposite of Johnny Greenwood's Phantom Thread, beautiful, lush, luxurious score.
Yeah, a little bit more in the vein of the There Will Be Blood kind of screeches. And assaults. But
dissonant Shostakovich stuff, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, but there is this heightened sense of torment in every shot that felt boring and tired, I think because it all felt so overheated. I just didn't believe it. I didn't really believe in this character. For all that Joaquin Phoenix's acting is compelling, I felt a little bit like this is two amazing talents who like went off into the corner and were really bouncing off of each other and vibing. But instead of finding that exciting as you did, Dana, I felt it as like a waste. Like, oh God, she could make such a great thing and he could make such a great thing, but they each need like a counterpart to bounce off of as opposed to kind of indulging their instincts. And I mean, Joaquin Phoenix is an astonishing actor, but this doesn't amount to a character I believe in or care about. Like, I just don't. He's been through so much. The fragmented way in which you experience his torment feels kind of heightened and hysterical rather than emotionally potent. The way in which that psychological torment would amount to someone who has such a sense of humor. And you're right, he's charming when he's kind of the way in which he plays most of his approaches to suicide and his kind of cat and mouse dance with himself and death are surprising and compelling. But I just don't, I didn't believe it. And as a result, you end up with this movie that thinks it's capital A art, but the final scenes make these choices about pacing and framing that assume you are deeply along for the ride. And if you are not, just play as extraordinary camp. Like it just didn't. It didn't work for me.
I do agree that the ending is weak and the way that the crime plot plays out is weak. In a strange way, I think what I'm saying is that I feel this enormous kind of artistic, like you say, vibrational energy between Lynn Ramsey and Joaquin Phoenix. And I think they're not fantastically served by being in this such a traditional genre noir story. But I also do appreciate a genre subversion and the way that she takes what you expect a movie about a hitman, you know, an unstoppable hitman with a hammer to look like, and instead turns it into things like that security camera footage scene, which is really a tour de force of direction.
Yeah, the movie gets compared to Dreams a lot, and it does really have those dreamlike qualities, but it also kind of reminds me of the fact that your own dreams are very rarely as interesting as you think they are, and offering telling other people about them is to be really, like, you don't tell other people your dreams because a lot of the time they're really boring. I think it falls a little bit into that category. Like, I get the sort of, you know, the mood of it and the accomplishment of it, but it doesn't really kind of hook into anything particularly profound for me.
I think she's up to something that bears following, whether you're in love with this particular movie or not.
All right. Well, it sounds like Dana thinks you should see this film. I would say wait for the next one. Sam, where do you come down?
I would not oppose your seeing this film.
Straight down the middle from Lynn Ramsey, starring Joaquin Phoenix. Come tell us what you thought on the Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. What is the relationship between the massive utility of Facebook for us as a social media platform and its business model? As has been made clear repeatedly, we are the product when something is free, i.e. our psychographic profile is being sold to third parties. What does Facebook know about us? How do they know it? To whom do they sell it? And what do those people do with it? To that end, people are now downloading what Facebook has on them. Apparently, it casts an ominously wide net, sometimes on its own, sometimes thanks to third-party apps. But rather than dig through multiple subfolders and files and try to understand how esoteric algorithms apprehend our, you know, inner reality, isn't it easier just to delete the frigging thing? Do we need to rebuild social media from the ground up with something like a real social contract behind it? We've made this beast out of our own desire to stay connected with the people we care about, but turned it somehow into a panopticon. What are we going to do about this, Julia? You and I are going to be on the opposite sides of this tennis net. So why don't you start?
I'm not sure I necessarily want to start with an aggressively pro-Facebook defense. But I do look at the set of attention that the company has gotten and then the specific topics around which that attention has focused and wonder sometimes if there's not a little bit of a disconnect. So in the Cambridge Analytica scandal, what we learned through great reporting is that according to Facebook's terms of service prior to 2015, any third-party app on Facebook could not just get access to all of the data on you, but data on all of your friends, which is a crazy policy. Like, that does seem like a absurdly loose policy, but also one we all signed up for by clicking agree on whatever stupid scrolly thing we didn't look at when we decided that Facebook was worth using. Subsequently, Facebook changed its policy. Cambridge Analytica was supposed to have deleted that set of data and apparently did not. And potentially it was used in some way by the Trump campaign to target small, tiny groups of people and individuals on Facebook with political advertising that I think one of the fears is may have helped put Trump in office. In response to this scandal, Mark Zuckerberg came before Congress, answered a bunch of questions about Facebook and privacy and Facebook's policies, and a whole cacophony of people have said, Facebook, it's too much. Finally, this is the breach. We must stop Facebook from taking over everything. I find this whole thing slightly weird. Like, I think that the anti-Facebook response right now has to do with a generalized sense that Facebook is too integrated into our lives broadly, that we don't really understand what we've given up in giving our data over to so many large institutions, in a sense that perhaps the government is derelict in not regulating Facebook or Google or Amazon or Apple or any of these big tech conglomerates more actively than it does. But the actual specific problem of using data, and I share those concerns and think that those companies should be regulated, but I think it's odd a little bit that this particular instance is the one that seems to have set off this firestorm. And when I think about the data that Facebook has on me and how it uses that data, as far as I know, I'm not that creeped out by it. Are you guys creeped out by it?
I mean, let me begin by saying I was on a path to deleting Facebook no matter what. It's not integrated into my life. I scarcely use it. I stay on it only because our show page is there. I don't like it. I don't like interacting with it. I do use Twitter. I use Twitter somewhat addictively, and that's replaced it completely. So for me, the trigger was 3/4 pulled to begin with.
In terms
of the revelations,
and you used to use Facebook for news. I remember having a conversation about this a few years ago that like your Facebook feed was full of news, and it was a place where you digested the news, which surprised me because once I had children, Facebook was just babies for me. Like once I became able to see babies' faces as like a photographs full of data that I was responsive to, then Facebook changed and became only personal for me. So you at one point it was a news source for you, right?
Yeah, it was. And it simply got replaced by Twitter, and one's ability to, and this does get at the heart of the matter for me, one's ability to curate and manage one's feed on Twitter is very different from Facebook, which is absolutely, you know, feeding you what it wants to feed you for reasons that are commercially strategic from their point of view. So one very quick thing, I mean, I think the revelations of how leaky Facebook is with your information to other interested parties, you know, to me is just a total red line that they've crossed. They've crossed it repeatedly. Mark Zuckerberg has been forced over the last 10 or so years to repeatedly apologize for what, at the end of the day, we have to admit is their essential business model, which is selling our personal information or our psychographic profile. What it demonstrates to me is that there is this inverse relationship between the amount of obvious and somewhat traditional advertising you see on a website or a social media utility and the wickedness of its business model. And, you know, you see sponsored content on Facebook. You don't see, to my mind, a lot of traditional looking advertising. What you see is highly targeted advertising made to look kind of native to your own self-curated experience. And here's the heart of the issue for me. It's the fake innocence of the algorithm that is, to me, the central evil of the social uses of the internet as they developed over the last 10 or 15 years, which is to say that something that is actually tailoring your perception of the world at large pretends to be a completely value-neutral platform generating content purely from your own inclinations, and therefore they bear no social responsibility at all because they're A, a platform, not a media company, and B, because it's not a bunch of editorially or politically driven human beings making these decisions, but an entirely personal demiurge known as the algorithm. And even if that were true, which I don't think it is true, I mean, I think it's a falsification of what essentially Facebook is, the degree to which that kind of metaphorical framing of what social media is, to me, is so essentially evil because no one, no individual anywhere in the system bears the responsibility of human judgment, and therefore the political consequences that flow from it. And we all slept on this until 2016, and now we live in essentially a nightmare world, thanks to political world, thanks to it. And the one thing I can do to assert my agency in a very agency denying system is to delete the product.
I mean, I think that's right. I think that's the impulse here, is to feel like this vast system of algorithms is allowing a set of players with varying agendas, whether it's people who want to sell you workout clothes or people who want to elect Donald Trump, to monetize the attention of literally billions of people. That's overwhelming. The human response to that is to feel overwhelmed. And retreating from Facebook and deciding you don't want to be part of that attention economy anymore seems like a reasonable emotional response to me. My question is whether it's actually a sensible response. Like, even your point about it has left us in the political situation we're in today, I don't think there's any evidence that suggests that whatever Cambridge Analytica was doing for Trump on Facebook actually put Trump over the top. And I think if you think about it, you know, if what they were doing was micro-targeting or psychographic targeting, and again, the reporting really varies on how much they actually did, political advertising is a force, not necessarily a force for good, but a force and has been a force in our elections for years and years and years. There was a ton of praise of Obama's campaign and use of micro-targeting in 2012, like, oh, clever Obama put one up over that stodgy Mitt Romney with his clever micro-targeting and his ability to know that you send this message to rural black voters here and this message to urban white voters here. Like, the idea that the people who are in the advertising economy are trying to tailor their messages to specific groups, mm-hmm. also an age-old idea, right. not necessarily a new and terrifying one. And
no, that's true.
It's like the lack of visibility into it scares people, I think. I mean, and I should also say here, like, obviously Slate is a player in this economy. So some of my views on this subject come from the fact that I've thought about the attention of all of our viewers and what we put in front of their eyeballs alongside our content, right? Like, part of how we have the resources to cover the Trump administration and cover the culture and cover everything else we cover and cover the Facebook hearings is because we're monetizing the attention and time that people spend with Slate with a kind of targeted advertising. We don't do it through Facebook, but, you know, a lot of those ads that show up on Slate, the ones that show you the lamp that you just put in the Crate and Barrel cart but didn't press purchase on, like the reason that lamp follows you around Slate is because we have contracts with programmatic ad providers who know something about your internet behavior. That's how all advertising-supported media is supported these days. So obviously I have dogs in the fight, but it just has made me wonder, like, how much is this an emotional response and how much is it a rational response?
Yeah, on a personal level, Steve, I kind of agree with you. I don't know that I feel that with as much ferocity as you do, but the idea of getting away from Facebook has appealed to me for a very long time for reasons actually that have a lot less to do with privacy than just with user interface. I just don't like that site at all. I always feel like I'm wandering through a mall there. I don't know how to find anything. There's too many boxes and places and messages, and anytime somebody tries to message me or invite me to something on Facebook, the chances I'll see it are infinitesimal. I just literally don't understand when I put something there who even of my friends is seeing it. Forget about advertisers. So that part of it is just is not appealing, and I never go to my personal page. It just has bats nesting in it, and I feel guilty whenever I go there because, you know, there's happy birthday messages from 2 years ago or something. But beyond the personal level, so yes, except for the fact that I would like to be able to continue to interact with our listeners on the show page and to, you know, maybe see pictures of babies of my college friends, I'd be happy to be off Facebook completely. But that still doesn't solve the larger problems that you're talking about. And as many of the articles that we read in prep for this segment mentioned, to deactivate Facebook is not to militate against Facebook or change anything about Facebook. And there's so much of the world, including, you know, other countries, that where that model that you just described of creating a filter bubble that people think is the real world holds and is maybe the only access to the internet that they have. So ultimately, I mean, we've talked about this before. There's three companies that are very, very powerful in our lives in America right now that I've always hated. I just feel an instinctive revulsion toward them, and they're Facebook, Amazon, and Uber. Now, Uber, I can just simply never use, not use the app. If I have to do ride sharing, I'll do Lyft. There's a way out of it. Amazon, it's practically impossible to avoid interacting with in some way, although I do try to draw the line of I'm not going to get books from Amazon. And Facebook is sort of in between the two. It's this sticky thing where I'm not even sure how many other, you know, Spotify, other apps that I use are kind of enabled through, Steve, what you aptly call the tentacular reach of Facebook. So it's sort of, it's a utility, and that's why it should be regulated, of course. But that's also why it's very hard to pry yourself out of it. It's like saying, oh, I'm not going to use tap water anymore or something. It's not quite to that point, but it's trying to be, right?
Right, it is. It does actually provide, I mean, like Uber and Amazon, it provides a service that did not exist before, which is the ability to find anyone you've ever met and connect with them. Like, that is actually a thing that was hard to do, that took reporting skills, that required you to keep pen and paper notebooks. Like, you can't always find everybody. Someone on a Slate Slack had an amazing idea the other day, which is that the best gift you can give your child right now is to name them something super ungoogleable. Like, name your kid Mary Smith. Name your kid like John Turner. Like, just name your kid something undistinctive, and that's how you will save them from like findability in any future biometrically inclined system. I guess once you get fingerprints, you're findable still. But anyway, I mean, I think your point about the user interface and the epistemic bubble, both of those are sort of related. One of the things that I think Facebook is struggling with as a company, and that I think might benefit from regulation, although might not, because regulation can be a very blunt instrument, is that they make a mistake that I think it's quite possible to make when you are creating online experiences, which is to listen so exclusively to the data that you don't have a human intelligence saying, what does this feel like? What does this amount to? What is the experience of using this thing? And so everything we see on those Facebook pages is optimized for our clickiness and our attention, but they don't amount to anything coherent or sensible. Like, it feels like such a random hodgepodge. There's no order in it. And we went through that with our recent Slate redesign of being like, okay, let's make a homepage that isn't just optimized for clicks. It tries to tell you something about the world and how it is organized. I guess that's the difference between a data-driven experience and a editorial experience. And I think there is a sense in which Facebook doesn't recognize that it is an editorial experience. Even if it's an editorial experience of just being a directory for humans, and it tries to get out of the news part of the editorial experience, which, like, why not? The news business is difficult. I don't think that's a dereliction on their part. But there's some way in which they're so smart about data, they're dumb about it. And it makes the product feel nefarious and expendable, which allows people to feel like it would be more plausible to hashtag delete Facebook than not.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we should also, I mean, I know we have to wrap, but we should also, this hasn't been with us forever. It did have predecessors. It had Friendster and MySpace. We have gotten used to the idea that Facebook is part of the ontological furniture, you know, but we shouldn't, because young people don't like it. And I think they face a demographic nightmare, honestly, as a business. I'm perfectly happy to hasten their demise. I think people quitting in numbers, I mean, everything is a trend, right? They're either growing or they're not growing. In Silicon Valley, not growing is the same thing as dying. The stupid shark metaphor that I won't even bother trotting out has been one of their favorites for 30 years. Deleting, I do think, has consequences, and very real consequences for Facebook, but I think they're facing doom no matter what. I scarcely know a person under 30 who really likes it, and I know nobody under the age of 20, and I know a lot of 15-year-olds right now, thanks to my daughter, not one of them uses it or would use it.
We're
going to leave it. They all have fake Instagram accounts.
Guess who owns Instagram?
I'm not saying that they're not going to survive as a company. I'm saying that that specific utility probably won't survive.
Fair enough. Listeners, you should either come to our Facebook page, or if you have already hashtag deleted Facebook, email us oldfashionedly at culturefest@slate.com to tell us where you think our conversation should be. I think
Could tweet at us. It could maybe take place on Twitter. We're trying to figure that out.
Tweet it at Slate Cult Fest. We are interested in hearing from you. If you would like to have a weekly digital colloquy with us about the topics we discuss here, where would you like that to take place? I think regardless of our varied feelings about the utility of deleting Facebook, we all agree that the user experience on our Facebook page isn't great right now, in part because Facebook doesn't show you guys any of the things we post there for most of you. So chime in. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll prod you about this a couple of times. We're trying to figure out where that community should live.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse. Dana, what do you have?
Well, I was thinking yesterday a lot about Toronto, where we went for the Toronto Film Festival last year and had a wonderful time, loved the city. And then to hear the news yesterday that they had been the victim of this apparent terrorist attack, this awful van incident that I believe I read was the worst act of mass violence in Canada in 30 years, really points to how different their society is from ours. Anyway, I was thinking about Toronto yesterday and what I could endorse from Toronto just to send them love from the GapFest. And since I don't know anything about contemporary pop music or music scenes, I had to do a bit of research about Toronto and came across a lot of great Toronto music. But the act that I'm going to endorse is this brand new band they just formed last year and came out with their first EP of two young women that call themselves Moscow Apartment. They're sort of a folk punk act, I guess you would say. They won an award last year for best young folk act in Canada. And Steve, I really think they're up your alley. You should look into their self-titled EP. It's called Moscow Apartment by Moscow Apartment. It's, I think, four or five songs. And they're very young, maybe in their early to mid-20s. They sound maybe a little like a mixture of Belle and Sebastian, but with all girls, and Nirvana or something. They have a kind of a punky edge, very short songs, beautiful harmonies, and they're just a really exciting young act, and probably only one of many great acts in the Toronto music scene that I know nothing about. So Torontonians, get on our social media and tell us what other music we should be listening to from your great city. So again, it's Moscow Apartment, and their first EP is called Moscow Apartment.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. Julia, what do you have?
I have a recommendation for the parents in our listenership. So, and I guess the under eights. So if there's any under eight listeners out there, you can also consider this recommendation. For the past decade or so, I have occasionally read pieces or heard conversations about Lego and the nefarious turn that the Lego company has taken, because instead of just giving you a bin of interchangeable parts upon which you can unleash your creative imagination to build whatever you desire. Lego has become like a model-making company where you buy a set and the set's parts go together and you follow instructions and you make a thing, and then you buy another set and you follow its instructions and you make another thing. And the critique is that this is a capitalistic monstrosity that turns our children into conformist direction followers and quashes their creativity while making the evil Danes at Lego rich. I didn't really understand, you know, so I followed that basic line of critique. Then I had kids who liked Lego, and I will say a couple things. One, it's totally true, and you end up spending way too much money at Lego What Monsters. Two, following the instructions to make the models is super satisfying and fun. Like, it's a game I love playing along with my kids. It's, like, really pleasing to, you know, think about your spatial skills and look at the little map and figure out how it fits together and to watch this impossibly complicated little object emerge thanks to your efforts. And Lego has a product that actually helps mitigate the wastefulness and mindlessness of the instruction following, which is Lego Creator 3-in-1 sets. So these are sets where you get one chunk of parts and three sets of instructions as to how you can put them together. So you make a Triceratops, then you take it apart. Then you make a pterodactyl, then you take it apart. Then you make a T-Rex, and you get kind of the pleasure and I think actually kind of instruction for like little kids that are learning their fine motor skills. And, you know, for my kids have gotten more dexterous and nimble by spending this time doing these Lego instruction following games. But you don't feel like you're just building a bookcase full of what you end up with, like toys that break if you're just buying new sets every time. Like, oh, I built a fighter jet, but every time I wave it around and bang it into something, it collapses into 30 million pieces and then I have to put it back together again. They don't really work as toys. The Lego Creator sets are what I would look out for if you are purchasing things for your children or giving gifts to people, because it's a nice marriage between the idyllic old way of Lego and the new way of Lego. And some of them even have secret fourth or extra instructions that you can download online. So like the great revelatory moment for my kids is we did all three of the 3-in-1 Lego Creator sets, but then one of my children noticed that there was a picture of a fourth dino, a Brachiosaurus of some kind on the back, and was like, what's that? Can we make that? Then we were able to download a PDF of directions from the Lego website and make a whole fourth one. So there was this feeling of discovery and excitement. So anyway, stipulated, there are some capitalist problems with the new version of Lego. Posited, it's also kind of fun. Resolved, the 3-in-1 sets are the best way to navigate this rough terrain.
Question about that. Isn't it still possible to just get boxes of undifferentiated colored Lego bricks and build whatever you want? Or you can only go to these?
Oh, no, you can still get everything. Don't worry. They haven't discontinued any products that I can see. And my kids have some of those and they enjoy that a lot. And increasingly, actually, since they've started playing with the 3-in-1 sets, they've started doing more just free play and making crazy things and worlds with all of their Legos. So, yeah, they still have that. But the models are, they're not just mindless and horrible. They're actually kind of fun.
All right, so I have two quick ones. The two pieces of culture I interacted this past week that I liked the most are a slim volume by the idiosyncratic art critic, art historian, John Berger. It's a collection of short pieces on artists going all the way back to the Chauvet cave paintings up through Cy Twombly and beyond, up through Basquiat and even beyond Basquiat. And what's perfect about them is they're short length, they're wholly unembarrassed, idiosyncratic, and often cranky appreciation or take on the artist. And then together, accumulatively, they give you a kind of art historical survey in a way, but it's criticism at its absolute best. It's the interaction of this sensibility, this, you know, highly, highly individual sensibility with equally individual works of art, and I loved it. And then secondly, I'm really, really digging. Jim Jarmusch made a movie called Dead Man, and he asked Neil Young not only to do the soundtrack, but to have Neil Young essentially plug in a guitar and play along to the film in real time in order to make the soundtrack. And I'm just digging. I could listen to Neil Young fuck around with a six string literally uninterruptedly for days and days and days on end. There you go. Soundtrack to Dead Man and Portraits, John Berger on Artists. Julia, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
Thanks to you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Drop us a note at Facebook at facebook.com/culturefest. We have a Twitter feed. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our production assistant is Daniel Schrader. Executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.